Once again, to the very, very often you do Haters on the Rocks. I'm joined this week by Dan.
That's me.
And newcomer Scott.
Hey, guys.
So, yeah, I think almost everyone this year, I've started off with this camera that it's been a while. And it's just been a really interesting transitional period for a lot of us. Sam isn't here this week, and he just got married and went on his honeymoon, which is why he's been away for a while, and Dan's graduated, or you still have a year?
No, I graduated in May.
Yeah, Dan's graduated, and the other one's just disappeared on us, so there's that. So hopefully, with Scott around and Sam back from his honeymoon, and me hopefully getting into the groove of my job, we should be more regular, which is still, I think, the two-week schedule that we're on. I might look into changing that up a bit by doing something in between, like shorter episodes that are like 10, 15 minutes.
That'd be cool.
In between, like every, you know, like a lot of podcasts do mini-sodes just to kind of fill in the gap between then. Anyhow, we're not going to spend too much time on figuring out where the hell we've been, so we're going to get started with this show. And one of the things, if I remember to do this, I want to start doing, is actually explaining how these podcast topics come about. Because a lot of times, they do just seem to be arbitrary things we want to talk about. But there's usually a rhyme or reason to them, in my head.
Yeah, I think so, generally.
Yes. So, this one, just to kind of set the stage, we're going to talk about sequels with long dormant time in between them. Sequels that come out maybe roughly 6 years or more after the previous iteration. And part of the reason for this was originally something we started to talk about when we were planning out the summer. We actually do pre-plan some of these shows. And it was around the time that Jurassic World came out.
And, well, along with, I think
Mad Max.
Yeah, Jurassic World probably was the catalyst, but Mad Max also was around, and then Terminator too, and we kind of just realized.
Terminator. And then the reason we picked it up this week was actually Mission Impossible was out this Friday.
Right.
And that was, Mission Impossible was a funny one for me, and this is part of the reason I actually wanted to do it this week, is that I'm a Mission Impossible fan, and I knew that Mission Impossible was based off of a TV show. I didn't know until recently that the Mission Impossible movies are actually sequels to the TV show, and not like a reboot or a remake of them.
Oh, really? I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I didn't know that either. It's weird.
Yeah. Because this is, how I figured it out is because I was doing research for Mission Impossible and stuff like that, and a lot of the original cast hated the original Mission Impossible movie because I'm assuming you two have seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah, not recently, though.
Okay, but John Voight's character, who's Ethan Hunt's mentor in the film, is the original, not John Voight himself, but he's the character who is the original lead in the Mission Impossible TV show.
Hmm.
So when he turned evil, it pissed off a lot of old school fans and the cast. So I was reading up about that, and that's how I realized it was a sequel to the TV series, because it does continue the story of some of those characters, and then it kind of kills them off so that you can start with Tom Cruise's character.
Right.
But for, talking about sequels with huge kind of delays in between them, Mission Impossible, the TV show, was something that came out in the 60s.
Mm.
And the first Mission Impossible movie was in 95. Or 96, I forget which one. The cross-section of those two audiences was probably really tiny at the time. But it was just one of those fun facts that I learned recently.
Probably even tinier now.
Yeah, I mean, somebody said mentioned it today, and I don't know if this is necessarily true, but I think all but like one, I don't necessarily think that's true, but they said like all but one of the original cast members are dead now.
Wow.
Again, it was an old show, and you have to imagine that this is the 60s, and they were playing, so they were probably in their 30s, 40s then, and, I mean, granted, 50 years still, you know, people could still live to 90 or 100 easily.
So, I wouldn't say easily, yeah. It gets harder the further you go along, but...
Yeah, a little bit.
And to kind of segue that into the overall point, that is something that I wanted to discuss as well, because... Doing a sequel to something that old, this design that you start having to walk between, like, are you doing this for the older fans, or are you doing this to kind of reignite interest in this property? So do you, throw out the baby with the bathwater, as they say.
I think that's the real big question is who are these sequels for? So...
I think it depends on I just got a weird taste in my mouth. It depends on what you're doing, I guess. Something like, James Bond has been around for forever, and like they modernize it slowly, gradually. But there are still gaps. Like the gap between Pierce Brosnan and the one before him was pretty big. Wasn't that the biggest gap between movies?
Yeah, I think then because that's 89 to 95. And I think it's almost similar to Casino Royale, which I think is 2000. No, okay, that's 2002 to 2006. But yeah, that is the biggest gap. When it's the history of James Bond is always funny because when you look at like, the first 10 years, there's like 7 movies, and then over the next 40 years, there's something like 14 of them or something weird like that.
Yeah, so I mean, like you get something like that where it's I wouldn't say timeless, but it's one of the most, especially on this list, it's one of the most timeless. Examples, you can put spies in any era, and it changes relatively little. But something like Mission Impossible, I guess, is a similar thing. It kind of becomes like the technology changes, obviously, reference changes and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think Mission Impossible, even though you have Bond, is more timeless in the sense that a lot of the early Bonds, because he was a British spy, it was easy. It was good guys versus bad guys. It was us versus the Russians.
Yeah.
Because it was the height of, and that was one of the things that GoldenEye did. Speaking of, the GoldenEye was one of those ones that's like, what does James Bond mean in this post Cold War era?
Mm-hmm.
And that was what the movie had to answer. And it's like, it's this huge gap where it's not even like, okay, we can roll them out and we can, you know, like, he can defeat them. It's like, it's been too long in between the fall of the Berlin Wall and when GoldenEye came out, so they had to touch on that because it was such a big part of the first 40 years of the franchise.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But it was no longer a thing.
But that like brings up an example of like series that hinge on a central topic, like Mission Impossible spy movies, and then you know James Bond being spy as well. But they kind of change their not really alliances, but they change like the subject matter, which is true of I guess not examples that we have on this list, but. Definitely in similar situations, other forms of media, like the Russian example, they were just the bad guys because everyone was just like, oh, they're just bad back then. Now, I mean, you could argue that they're not. You could argue that they still are, whatever. But you know, antagonists in typical archetypes like spy movies or action movies kind of have changed to stuff like futuristic things, if it's that sort of genre, or like from Russians to Germans, Russians to Israelis, stuff like that.
Well, as I have to say, we're a bit more, and I hate to say sensitive because I know people, but I do think we are a bit more sensitive, for better in some regards, because it's not, at some point, you just made Asians the bad guys during like World War II, and that was an easy sell.
Right.
Then the Russians were bad guys, and now, you know, and then there was a period in the 2000s where it was like Muslims.
Yep.
You put Muslims in, and they were always terrorists, and they were the bad guys. And now we're kind of like, you don't want to classify an entire group of people. Like that.
Right.
And that is something that I do think is, going back to Bond, I think it's something that the franchise has had to evolve with because, like, for a time, if you watch, like, Roger Moore, a lot of his was evil businessmen, which is another big trope.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't necessarily do that. So, when you get Daniel Craig's films, Like, there aren't really, there's no trope, there's no type of bad guy anymore.
I mean, he does kind of rest on the laurels of evil business tycoon in Quantum of Solace, but in general, in all of his movies, it's been against more, like, a big corporation in, like, the Quantum from the first
yeah.
two, or, like,
and
battling the past as, like, a theme, I guess. So they kind of tackle more mature, quote-unquote mature things, not mature in the general sense of, like, older, but mature as in, like, they've become less one-dimensional, and they're less, oh, the enemy's just Russian because they're bad, and they're more, oh, the enemy's a business tycoon because of this actual reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was going to say, to that point, you do have to build up, you in order to kind of create that all-encompassing enemy, you have to build them up over multiple films, and I think it's really difficult to kind of maintain that momentum, which is kind of what we see with the Terminator franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Terminator in the first one is like this deadly killing machine. I mean, the first Terminator, I always say, is kind of a horror film because it's two humans versus this robot they just can't stop.
Mm-hmm.
The second one evens the odds. It's robot versus robot, even though it's a more advanced robot. And then it kind of gets to the point, like, what can we do with the franchise? And it's robot versus robot again. Then it's like, we'll show this war that nobody ever really wanted to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fair thing to say. No one really wanted to see it.
And have you folks seen Genesis?
Nope.
Not yet. I've been really afraid to. You know, sequels have that effect on me, especially these with a lot of space in between them. They fill me with apprehension, and I don't like that feeling, so I usually just avoid them for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, and I won't spoil it then, but I will say this, and I will get to Jurassic World in a second. I think this has a similar problem, in that especially with Terminator, though. Terminator isn't necessarily, it's a timeless movie, but it's a period piece. Mm-hmm. Terminator 1's an 80s film, Terminator 2's a 90s film, but not only that, they have a finite amount of time, because they've always given us a deadline as to when this war takes place.
Right.
And the further and further we get from the original movie, the closer and closer we get to Judgment Day, we get to the war with Skynet, and it's like the films, because you can't, and they try in Genesis, they try to replicate the 80s for a bit, but you can't necessarily always replicate prior generations, so it can't be a modern film too much, because it's like, this war should be here by now. Like, I believe the war starts, what, 1997?
I was just going to go check what time it was, technically.
I think originally it was 1997. It's been pushed up and up. Again, as they got further and further, like Terminator 3 had to push it up because 1997 was before Terminator 3 came out. And then Terminator Salvation, and then Terminator, just again, spoilers, Terminator Genesis pushes it up to 2017.
Sorry, related to that, but have either of you guys seen either or both of the Total Recall movies? Because I don't remember what time period the original takes place in. Is it like the super far-off future?
I don't remember if it had a time frame. I assume it is.
Because I was just thinking of other movies that are like that. Because like you have all these movies that are dated. Like I remember iRobot had a specific time that like the robots uprising happened. I think it was 2018, and we don't have driverless cars yet, but you know, 3 years, I don't think we will have the entire society based off of them. We're apparently supposed to have four generations of robots in 3 years, kind of similar to like the thing that people say about the hoverboards from Back to the Future. But what I was getting at was, like, you see a lot of like standalone movies that, you know, have this set date and then they pass it, and but they don't reference it. But Terminator's one that obviously does, and I think Total Recall, if it references a specific date, probably does, and that had a long gap between the original and the new one too. But I know they changed a lot of the source material on what was happening to kind of retcon that. Like in the original Total Recall, it happened on Mars, whereas the new one was kind of like all on Earth, but it was all like a recall was its own.
From what I heard, it's also already bad.
Yeah, but like I'm just saying, like I don't know if they changed a lot of the story, maybe to get rid of that sort of aspect of, oh, we've passed the time that this is supposed to happen, or oh, we're too close to it. Maybe we should do something different to atone for that almost.
Well, I mean, you could put in a vague disclaimer of the time period, so nobody would be any of the wiser. Like, there's a lot of movies that you don't necessarily have to, you don't necessarily know the time frame, just because it's, like, again, Terminator has a specific end date. They had an end date that they went with for the first film, and they went with it for the second film. And then it's like, crap, these movies are successful, and we have to keep on making them. And I feel like every movie since then, it's like, how can we extend this format? And nobody's been able to figure it out in a meaningful manner.
Yeah.
The closest thing, I think, is the Sarah Connor Chronicles, which is just them really just time-jumping over Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm. I just checked, by the way. Total Recall happens in 2080, I guess. So I guess we're way far off, and we've only had two movies, so I think we're good.
And they're not related, right?
I think they're their own thing.
Okay.
They're not like a reboot, necessarily, but they're their own versions or retelling of the story.
Yeah, like own adaptation, because they're based off of a book, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so just to kind of get through the summer... Jurassic World was another one that was, what is it, 14 years in the making? How old is Jurassic World?
It's been Jurassic World for a while. Like
The Lost World. The Lost World came out in 2001 or 2000? I should know.
Let's go find out.
While he finds this out, I would just say I have already seen the Jurassic Park movies for the first time earlier this year, so I don't have a great memory of them.
Jurassic Park 1 came out in 93, Lost World was 97, and then Jurassic Park 3 was 2001.
Okay, so 14 years in between films.
Yeah, and a lot of that was development time, like you said.
Yeah, and to that point, and this happens sometimes. We don't have this example on here, but Superman Returns does the same thing. It ignores some of the sequels. Not ignores, but there's nothing in Jurassic World that says you have to have seen Jurassic Park 2 and 3 to understand this.
Definitely not to understand, but to appreciate certain parts of it, which I think is a better way to do it, because it kind of is like throwing a bone for the old fans, more than anything.
Well, I mean, it depends on how many old fans there are of Jurassic Park 2 and 3, from what I hear.
Well, I was more referring to general, the aspect of, I don't want to spoil the movie because it is fairly recent, but there's a very clear reference to the first movie about halfway through it, and it's like, that's not, you don't have to see the first movie. I went with my girlfriend, she hasn't seen any of the Jurassic Park movies, and so I told her, hey, this is, you know, spoiler, blah, 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 from the first movie. And she was like, oh, that's cool. And I, like, thought it was really cool, but she kind of didn't realize it, and then once she did, was like, oh, that's neat, but didn't miss anything because of that.
Oh, no. The first film is rough. You get a much better appreciation. But this one actually kind of harps on the idea of you seeing the first film, because yeah. One of the entire segments of this film is like, oh, yeah, that's that.
Yeah. No, that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, and even B.D. Wong's character, I believe, is from the original
film
as well.
Yeah, he's like the only actual original actor, I believe.
I double-checked the IMDb page just like the other day, and just to make sure that he's not just playing a different role.
Right.
It's the same character. So, and he's the only one, as far as I know, unless there's some guy
who
worked on
Jurassic World. He's the only one to Jurassic World, from what I read, I think.
Yeah.
There's between the two, like, what's his name? Jeff Goldblum's character was in 1 and 2.
Yeah, I think that the characters from 1 show up in 2 and 3,
right.
But not together. Like, I think he's in 2, but not 3.
Right. And Sam Neill's in 1 and 3, but not 2.
Yeah. So that's the thing. And then I think they mentioned, like, the original creator, you know, dies in between the films or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you get a much better appreciation of Jurassic World if you've seen the original.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those films, and it's hard to say because it did amazingly well. So mm-hmm. I think they waited the right amount of time to bring it back, and they captured people's imagination, which I also think is really ironic because that was one of the plot points of the movie.
Yeah.
Is that if you can't just keep on doing dinosaurs again because people are going to get bored.
Yeah.
So you have to give them something new and genetic, and it's the plot of the movie, but it's also kind of what happened, because Jurassic Park was the big... actually, The Land Before Time was the big boom for dinosaur interest in movies. but Jurassic Park was kind of this huge ordeal, and I'm afraid of what's going to happen with Jurassic World 2, because I'm afraid they don't know how to make sequels to these movies. That's the same thing that happened with 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, where do you take this brand after Jurassic World?
honestly, I know that they've already talked about making a Jurassic Park 5, I guess. Is that what we're referring to?
Jurassic World 2.
Jurassic World
they
2,
They announced
yeah.
it for 2018.
Yeah, so they're already doing it, and that's fine, whatever, if they want to. But I think, honestly, from an integrity standpoint, stopping at World would probably have been the perfect way to kind of like put a bookend on it, because it doesn't answer questions that like the first one's brought up, but it kind of it leaves it on a good point where it's like, you don't have to do anything else to muck it up anymore. We don't have to go into like anything deeper than genetic mutations or whatever, or genetic
yeah.
splicing and stuff. Like, it kind of handles everything that you've got. The only thing I could see it doing is a similar thing to World, where it's just like, oh, let's reboot it again in 20 years when this other thing happens.
Yeah, sadly enough, you do not become the third highest grossing movie of all time and not expect a sequel in this day.
Right, exactly. That's why I say, from an integrity standpoint, you know, I would not do any more, but I understand why. I feel like they're going to cheapen the brand by doing that, especially because it's playing almost solely off of the popularity of the Raptors and Chris Pratt, which is unfortunate. Unfortunate for him, though.
Well, I mean, yeah. This isn't part of our conversation, but I do just find it. This is actually... This would be the 6-year anniversary of Avatar, so that's a popular movie that has not had a sequel yet, even though they announced 2 and 3 ages ago.
Yeah, like a month after the movie came out, right?
Yeah, so it's been 6 years since that. So when we do this podcast, I think the first one's due in 2018.
All right.
So
we'll see.
When we do this podcast again, hopefully Avatar 2 is out by then.
Hopefully.
Now, I think, and I could be wrong, but I feel like this is probably the longest stretch on our list, which is Mad Max, which is something like 25 years?
It's a really long time. Didn't it skip all of the 90s and the 2000s?
Yeah, Mad Max. Yeah, 30 years.
Wow.
Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome came out July 10th, 1985.
Wow.
So 30 years
exactly.
in between sequels. And none of the original cast came back.
But sure, a lot of them have aged and might not be interested in driving in these cars anymore.
I think at some point Mel Gibson wanted to,
but then he threw a step out.
Probably, but yes. but it is a sequel. It assumes a level of familiarity with the character.
Which is probably the most unfortunate for that series, because I think you have to understand a lot more what's going on in that series than Terminator. No, maybe not than Terminator, but than Jurassic World for sure. I think Jurassic World stands alone the best of these three.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the movies, I think that basically Mad Max takes it and then Mission Impossible. Yes, I've seen Mission Impossible already. But, yeah, I mean, it's funny. I don't know if... have you seen the original Mad Max films?
I have. I haven't seen the new one, though.
I have not, but I have seen the new one, so...
Okay. I will... Because they've all been loosely connected,
mm-hmm.
but they've never... They aren't... They're sequels to each other in that they follow the character of Max, but they don't necessarily assume, like, okay, you need to know what happened... in one to understand what happens in two, and you need to understand what happened in two to understand three, and you need to understand three to see what happens. None of that happens. Like, it has, like, minus spoilers, but there are flashbacks, which I find kind of funny because it's different actors, of the first Mad Max where Max's wife gets killed, and they briefly show that in Fury Road. If you hadn't seen the first Mad Max, you probably don't understand. I guess you'd understand that his loved one died, but that was basically the climax of the first film.
Yep.
So they have flashbacks of that and stuff like that, but it's a really good standalone film in that you can understand it from beginning to end. But having seen the originals, you'd get a better understanding. But I have to say, 30 years is an insane amount of time, because who is that marketed to? Just to age myself, that is my lifespan.
It's marketed to the post-apocalyptic archetype, I think, or that aesthetic.
Yeah, a lot of the people are fans of that whole theme of a post-apocalyptic world, and I think it also has to do a lot with the video game series based on the same characters. I don't think it's a coincidence that this movie comes out around the same time that they're. Has the Mad Max game come out yet?
That's out September.
Yeah, September. So it's definitely not a coincidence. They, you know, it's free publicity for one and the other. So,
well, I mean, and kind of to the point we were talking about earlier, Mad Max also works with these sequels because it's an indeterminate time frame. Like, they don't say like this is the year 20X whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is the future, and that's all you need to know.
Yeah.
Like, you don't necessarily know if there's 1 year in between films or 15 or 30 years in between films. Right. I doubt it's 30, because Max still looks pretty damn young.
Well, I was actually going to say, related to that, I think, honestly, I think a lot of series are afraid to do something like this, where they're afraid to be like, oh, you know, Mel Gibson was Max in the first three, and then it's like, what's his name?
Tom Hardy
in the fourth one, but he's the same character. I think a lot of series are afraid to do that, but I actually think that that's a kind of an interesting thing to do, and I think more series should kind of try and do it, because, like you said, it's a timeless example, and Tom Hardy and Mel Gibson were, I'm assuming, around the same age when both of them were filmed, right? They look about the same age, same point in their life, at least. I think it's kind of cool to say, all right, you know, 30 years later, we have Mad Max Fury Road. We're going to tell another story of Max's life, but it's going to be a different actor, different technological feats, all that stuff. So we can do more to show this.
And I can see it both ways, because I mean, I've hidden no facts bones about this. The James Bond is my favorite film franchise, mm-hmm. and that is a franchise that has been designed around, we need to replace this guy every 10 years or so.
Right, and they do exactly that.
And we continue this, and nobody bets an eye. And it's the same, superheroes are, I mean, there's been like six Batmans, Superman going on our third Spider-Man.
Yeah. But like, they all exist within their own series at the same time. I feel like this is more an example close to James Bond, where the only actual continuity technically with James Bond is does the Roger Moore one interact with the Sean Connery one continuity-wise?
They all interact up until Craig's era.
Oh, up until Pierce Brosnan's, I thought.
No, the only reason I ever say that is because, Connery has the most connected one because he has Spectre running throughout his films.
Yep.
But I usually just point out the fact that every one of the Bonds pretty much mentioned his dead wife, which happened to one guy,
right.
Which is the one guy who has one movie. But like, for the most part, it's always brought up with Brosnan, it's brought up with Dalton, it's brought up with Moore at some point.
Uh-huh.
And I think directly Moore also has the connection, even though they couldn't show him, of putting out Brofeldt at the start of one of his films.
But I mean, I think they technically considered Pierce Brosnan won like a reboot. That's why, like, you have M has a continuity between them,
but Pierce Brosnan does
not.
That's a whole different ball game between M with Brosnan and Craig.
Right. I mean, they say that it's a reboot between the two, and M is like the reboot. You know, the string, the most literal string, because obviously they've changed actors. But I mean, I think that they're hinging themselves too much on what fans want, which is they want to explain that, all right, this actor did his own Bond. This actor did his own Bond.
Yeah, I think this is some, and I understand it. This is the mentality that the internet sometimes has.
Yeah.
Is that everybody's stupid.
Yeah.
So if you change actors, nobody's going to understand it's the same character.
Right, but I think an incorrect statement to think. I think that they should have more freedom to change actors as they want and say, oh, it's the same guy, it's just a different story that he did.
Yeah, but I think with Mad Max, it's very important that it was also a huge time frame.
Because
it was like 30 years. So people probably, you know, like, oh, I remember that movie, but who, like, you probably, you know, like, I wouldn't do it like 3 years from now and have somebody new as Max.
Right. At that point, I would assume it's a reboot of the series.
Yeah, I think that's fair. If you do it too soon, then you're rebooting the series. If you do it with enough time in between, you could arguably pass them off as the same character.
Yeah, because I think that runs the difference between, like, if you do a new Spider-Man next year, which, well, they're doing, not next year, but, you know, if you do a new Spider-Man,
oh, yeah,
it's assumed that it's a reboot. But if you do a new Spider-Man 30 years from now, it could be, I mean, Spider-Man's a bad example, but if you do it 30 years from now, it could be tied to, you know, Amazing Spider-Man, the series from 2 years ago.
And I mean, kind of to your point, and to kind of get us back on topic, this is what happened with Brandon Routh and his Superman Returns, because that was a sequel to Christopher Reeve's Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also one of those weird sequels in that it assumes that 1 and 2 happened, but not 3 and 4.
Right.
I understand why they do that, but I just, like, there are ways to do it without just making continuity really iffy. I guess they really wanted Superman to have a kid.
We all wanted that, too.
But, I mean, because that's why, because, I mean, if you did it after 3 and 4, it makes no sense. Him and Lois always sheep together in 2.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those, like, you know, like, I understand these were terrible films and you probably don't want to remind people of them, but at the same time, I think it's just more confusing to be like, okay, this happened, but that didn't happen. You have to know this, but you don't have to know that.
It's kind of like doing the Wolfenstein example, where the original all the Wolfensteins technically are the same thing. The rebooted Wolfenstein was from 2009, and that was so poorly received that the next Wolfenstein that happened, which was the New Order, which was 4 years later in 2013, or 14, I should say, it just kind of retconned everything that was bad about the 2009 Wolfenstein and said, oh, well, we're going to choose this one character, though. We liked her. I know it was a reboot and we're not acknowledging her, but, you know, her, she was good. We're going to take that. They're kind of picking and choosing what they want of the continuity.
Yeah, which I guess is their prerogative. I just always felt it was cheap. Like,
it is cheap.
Like, yes, nothing's going to be perfect. Just kind of take your lumps and deal with it. But kind of going back to your point beforehand, and especially being that he's on Flash, or he's on Arrow now, I've always felt that Brandon Routh got shortchanged. Because they hired him to play a pale imitation of Christopher Reeves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Christopher Reeves is an amazing Superman, but I just felt bad. Like, you shouldn't be asked to be like, I get it, you're an actor, but you shouldn't be paid to act like somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you should be able to put your own stamp on these characters you bring to life and not try to be like, okay, I'm going to be Christopher Reeves 2.0.
Right, it's kind of like the example of the Joker. Each Joker is their own sort of entity. They kind of exist. They don't. I mean, they exist on their own, but they also kind of portray a different type of way that you can do the character.
Yeah, and I think part of that is because so many people, and I've heard this time and time again. Like, Jack Nicholson was the ultimate Joker. Heath Ledger's the ultimate Joker. And you know, people are like, can Jared Leto be? I mean, everybody has their Joker. For 20 years, it was Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Before that, it was Cesar Romero, and yes, I mean, none of us are that old, but I know people who, I grew up on the Cesar Romero's Joker, I watch reruns. I mean, I actually grew up on Mark Hamill's Joker, and that's Joker. Nobody's ever going to touch Mark, but it's funny to hear people say, oh, this guy will never be able to top this performance. Like, we've seen it time and time again. Like, you just, you know what you like, because you know you like something because you have it, but you don't know you dislike something until you, so a lot of people are just like, I like this one thing, I can't imagine it being any other way, and then somebody comes along and does something different, and it's like, oh man, I can't imagine, I can't believe I like this version, which is one of the stupidest things I've ever, I understand it, but I always hate when people are like, oh, I like this thing, I hate that old thing now. I'm like, you can enjoy more than one thing at a time, it's humanly impossible to do that.
That was very true.
Anyhow, my random rant of the week.
Yeah, that was we kind of, I'm sorry, I kind of derailed topics there a lot too. I kind of strung us to weird places as well in that long.
Oh, no, I mean, span. I mean, we were talking about Superman Returns, which was another one that was, I think it was 19 years between sequels.
I didn't even see Superman Returns, so you know, I don't even. I learned that it was, you know, at the same continuity a couple of years after it came out, and I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting, and that's about it.
Yeah, like, it's kind of like, who are you marketing to? Because you, like, again, I feel like the people who originally saw Superman, you know, like, it's a sequel after Superman 4, but you're talking about a film that's continuing a continuity from a film in the early 80s, so almost over 30 years
yeah.
before it came out, and you're trying to kind of get that nostalgia. Younger fans would be more keen to know Superman from stuff like the animated series in Justice League or even Smallville at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was weird to be like, oh, we're going to make a sequel to this film when all these other things with Superman came out in between then that people would be more familiar with because the character... Like, it's one of those weird situations where it's a sequel to a movie that hadn't been around in a while, but it's a character who was around in the mainstream several times,
yeah.
Because in addition to that, he also had deals in character New Adventures of Superman. And, you know, he was on Justice League, he was on Smallville at the time. So it wasn't like, oh man, it's been a while since Superman. No, it's like, we get Superman, you don't need to like, okay, we're going to go back and tell people who Superman is again.
No, I feel that, and that happens with, I think, a lot of superheroes, especially just because it's like a timeless thing. You know, like, you can do it so many different ways as well, but they're a constant, basically, and especially pop culturally. Like, Superman is one of the most popular, if not the most popular and well-known superheroes. Like, he's just always going to be known. Whether or not, you know, you say a Superman and I think of Brandon Roth's character or I think of Smallville's character, you know, that's different. But he's always going to be around in pop culture and mainstream media.
And I think it would have been best to try to give him his own take on the character instead of trying to resurrect this other character that was popular.
Yeah.
This other take, I should say, on the character that was popular. It was good. It was phenomenal. But yeah, it did nothing to help that movie or that actor.
Yep. Related to that, I think, related to this, and related to the previous conversation about changing actors but the same role, you look at something like Rhodey's character from the Iron Man series, and he actually is one of the few characters, I think. Probably the only character, at least of note, who has actually changed actors in the Marvel Cinematic Universe so far. One other, actually, is one of Thor's henchmen. That's the only two characters I can think of. But, you know, I think Terrence Howard had his own version of Rhodey, but I also think that Don Cheadle has a different, slightly different version as well. Maybe that's just because the character hasn't developed as much, but I think the two actors have done their own takes, even within the same universe.
Yeah. Even though, and
yeah,
I've gone on record
fair.
Before, I much prefer Terrence Howard's version of Rhodey.
I actually like Don Cheadle's more.
I this is a discussion Scott and I have had before.
Yeah.
It's more so that I just believe Terrence Howard with Robert Downey Jr. more than I believe Don Cheadle with Robert Downey Jr.
Okay.
But Iron Man hasn't been rebooted. It hasn't been 6 years in between sequels.
No.
So it doesn't count. And we got plenty of movies to go. But just kind of switching gears, because we have talked about movies a bit so far. It does happen often. You actually mentioned one earlier. But video games also go through this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't necessarily think about it, because it is a relatively new industry. I mean, it's about 40 years, if that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a much lower gap that you can cap space you can play with.
Yeah, especially in this day and age where everything gets a sequel every year.
Right.
There are games and franchises that do go dormant for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first example that comes to mind, and probably the most famous, is Metroid. Super Metroid came out in 1994, and the franchise would become dormant after that for 7 years.
Despite being one of Nintendo's biggest, and they still tout it as, you know, being one of the big Nintendo ones. You know, you think of Nintendo, I would assure you that most people would put Metroid in the top five, and despite that, it had a huge gap.
Yeah, 8 years, actually. And not only was it coming back, but it was coming back as a first-person shooter.
Right, totally changed. Well, that's what I think a little bit different, something that can change... That we can talk about in a different way than movies, because movies, the only thing they can really change with that is genre, more or less. Like you said, Terminator, they kind of change the genre. I think games have a different dichotomy in like what they can change between adaptations. You can change altogether the viewpoint, the character, the setting, even. Like, you can change plenty of different things about games and have
it
series or character.
But often, games don't take that radical departure. Not There are franchises that do it, and maybe one day we'll talk about stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because you have Metroid Prime. And even though I think Metroid Prime is one of the biggest ones, I actually think the biggest to me is Grand Theft Auto. I don't even know if people remember the first two at this point.
Most of the mainstream fan base don't.
Yeah, it's probably reference lost them. In memory.
Yeah, I remember that. Because the first one I played, I guess not even first two, first three. The first one I actually played was GTA London. But yeah, that was a radical change. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Metroid Prime. This was back when I first started to get into the internet, and I just remember the reaction being like, it's this unproven studio.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see Samus in first person. How's it going to keep that isolation? How's it going to do this and that? And I assume for many people, it is one of the most beloved games. One of the best games in the Metroid franchise.
In a lot of franchises overall, too. I've seen a lot of people put it on their number one list.
Yeah. So it's a rare example of... And, you know, I don't necessarily think you can do this all the time, but we are kind of in the middle of that right now. I don't necessarily think Metroid Prime Federation Force is going to be Metroid Prime for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
That's own discussion.
Yeah.
But there are other games who have done that too. We have also on this list Fallout, and like you said, I mean, Grand Theft Auto did that too, but Fallout changed quite a bit too. Similarly, changed from not a side-scroller, but a top-down view to a first-person slash third-person shooter.
RPG.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, shooter RPG.
A lot of that came with the Switch from which studio owned it, because there was originally another Fallout 3 that the original studio, I think was Black Island Studios, mm-hmm. had planned. And I guess things just sort of fell apart, and then Bethesda acquired the rights, and they were just like, we're not going to make that kind of game. We're going to make a first-person shooter. And they did.
Right. That is true. I mean, Metroid didn't... Technically, it changed studios, but it didn't change, like, ownership. I had another example of something that did that, too. But it's kind of like Mario. Like, Mario stays the same, but they do different, slightly different things with it, I guess. They treat it liberally, I guess, for what it can do.
And kind of talking about Mario, and this is kind of cheating because he was around a bit,
mm-hmm.
but Luigi's Mansion was another one that was something like 12 years in between the original and the sequel.
Yeah.
Even though Luigi the character is around in most Mario games, Luigi's Mansion, and that, kind of to the Metroid point, it wasn't as radical of a shakeup, but this was a game that was given to another studio who saw the original and were like, okay, we're going to... It was like, we like the idea of one giant mansion, but we're going to make this more episodic. We're going to make this more level-based.
And they also changed... I mean, not that it's uncommon to change the hardware between game series that have long gaps, but they changed it from a console game to a handheld, which changed up how you played it as well, because they made it more mission-based.
Yeah. So, and I mean, just to kind of rattle these off, because if... Of all the companies, I think Nintendo is very, not necessarily guilty of this, but it is one of the companies that tends to do this often. Kid Icarus Uprising was like 20 years in between.
They also changed the genre quite a bit, too.
Oh, I mean, quite a bit's an understatement.
Yeah.
It went from a 2D platformer to a half on rail shooter, half third person shooter.
Yeah, that was like, it's similar to Metroid where it was so radical, but I mean, Metroid had some breathing room. It did develop. I mean, technically, Kid Icarus had two titles before Uprising, but they were basically the same thing, and they fleshed out the entire world, not just like the character, and changed it up. They breathed entirely new life into it.
Yeah, I mean, honestly speaking, if they never make a Kid Icarus game, like the first two again, I'm okay.
Yeah,
but I would love to see a follow up to Uprising. I mean, this was one of the benefits of it being a long, dormant franchise, and it kind of being an NES game. It's like they were able to create personalities for all of these characters, because beforehand there wasn't much known about them.
Right.
Like, if anything, I would imagine more people know Pit from the Captain NTV show than they would the actual Kid Icarus video games. But
maybe. Like, Smash Bros. Is the best place people learned about.
Well, I meant before,
yeah.
Like, Smash Brothers. And I was going to say Smash Brothers is the reason he got his game, because Sakurai enjoyed the character, and he gave him a brand new redesign in Brawl. And that was kind of where that resurgence came from.
Yeah.
And of course, he was the one who decided to make the game. Pikmin's another one. I think Pikmin was...
It was 8 years, I guess.
8 years? Yeah.
But Pikmin, I mean, it seems kind of like a long time, but it actually wasn't. All it did was skip one console generation, which isn't... Like,
which is,
Metroid has done that, too. Metroid did that altogether with the N64, but... Well, like, Kirby's done that, and Kirby's not on this list. Kirby skipped the GameCube altogether, with the exception of Air Ride, which was a spin-off.
Yeah, but Kirby had a bunch of handheld games in that time.
Right, but, I mean, he skipped an entire generation.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Donkey Kong was also there. Because if you... I mean, it depends, because, like, Jungle Beat was in between there.
Mm-hmm. Another situation of it being a spin-off title, though, more...
Yeah.
I actually don't have this on the list, but when you said Donkey Kong, it made me think. Banjo-Kazooie, massive, massive change to genre, like the other one examples, and also massive gap between them.
Yeah, and there's a reason people don't talk about that.
There's a reason people do talk about it, though, too, is because it is so different, and people do like it so much.
I guess on the same point of career, I think Perfect Dark was another one that was like 5 or 6 years.
Technically, GoldenEye, you could argue.
Yeah, we're not going to argue that, because I think there's a difference between making a sequel and trying to milk a license. Everybody remembers GoldenEye, right? Yeah, we're going to do this other thing called GoldenEye. It has nothing to do with the first one, but it's called GoldenEye. You're going to like it.
Yeah, remember how GoldenEye was so good back then? Yeah, back then. Remember how it's still dated? Yeah, let's make a new version of it that's dated.
I'm never talking about that. I'm talking about the Rogue Agent.
Mm-hmm.
And then they made the GoldenEye remake, which I actually do like, but that's a remake. And then I think one of the more famous examples recently, and probably one that is so much to blame for this pixel art fest we have right now, is Mega Man 9.
I think that there's... I could, again, argue this a different time altogether, but I think there's a different reason for the pixel art love fest that's going on.
Oh, I know, but
it definitely contributes to it, for sure.
Yeah, because Mega Man 9 was one of the first remakes.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay, this game, you know, like, we've had to advance this franchise as technology improved, and, you know, we kind of hit a wall. We don't know what to do with it. So let's go back to the drawing board. Let's go back to what worked the first time, and let's try to envision this as a modern game. And that's what they did with Mega Man 9, and then eventually Mega Man 10.
You know, I always thought that was funny about Mega Man 9 and 10, too, because I am a big fan of the mainline Mega Man games, but not any of the other spin-offs. And honestly, the only Mega Man games that are not in the same style as 9 and 10 are pretty much 7 and 8, maybe you could argue 6. All the rest of them are basically the NES style, though, so I find it weird that they decided, oh, you know, we've taken this series so far through time and everything, let's bring it back to its roots, when they never even got that far visually anyway.
Well, I think part of it was because for a while the X franchise became the main one.
Yeah, and people didn't like 7 and 8's art style departure as much.
Yeah, because it became more anime-esque.
Yeah,
and I think the other thing, and you know, this is why video games are a bit more iffy, because you know, like, you're correct. Like Mega Man, like the first 5 or 6 Mega Man are actually NES games.
Yeah.
So they, like 9 and 10 looks more like the franchise than 7 and they don't look like outliers if you look at the entire franchise.
Yeah.
But then you throw in X, you throw in Legends, you throw in Battle Network, you throw in
Base and all of his side stuff and whatever.
Yeah. There's a lot of Mega Man. So for them, it was like we're going back to basics.
Yeah.
We're just throwing out all this other junk. But, yeah, as a whole, if you just look at Mega Man 1 through 10, and you ask for the ones that are different, people are going to pick the Saturn and PlayStation versions.
Right. I just thought it was weird that they decided to change the art style so radically when it's like, it wasn't actually radical at all in the first place. The furthest they got was PlayStation graphics.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. What else is there? Oh. I've said that I think Metroid Prime and Mega Man are probably the most famous examples, then I think we should talk about the most infamous example of a long-delayed sequel, Duke Nukem Forever.
Yeah.
Oh, lordy. It's a doozy.
Duke Nukem Forever is... that old adage just comes to mind. Be careful what you wish for, you might just get it.
Yeah.
I never heard that replied to Duke Nukem, but it makes a lot of sense in that situation.
Yeah, it should have stayed dead, to quote Elrond from The Hobbit. should have stayed dead.
The problem with that, though, is like people would still be asking for it. And I forgot to mention this at the start of our show. One of the other reasons we wanted to do this was around the time that the Shenmue 3 Kickstarter was announced, which we will get to in a second.
Yep.
But, yeah, people were like, I want it, you know, Duke Nukem Forever, it's been in development, we want it. Eventually, okay, we're going to make it. Yes, we made the game. This isn't what we wanted. We don't care. You just kept on asking for it. We threw a title on it. There you go.
That I always like to tell people who hate Duke Nukem Forever, though, the exact same thing that Randy Pitchford said about it, which I know Randy Pitchford is not the most liked person in the game industry, especially nowadays, but I mean, like, what I like to tell people is basically he said it perfectly. Duke Nukem Forever just had to happen. It doesn't matter if it was good or bad. It just had to happen so that people could stop talking about it. It's kind of like Half-Life 3. Good or bad, everybody wants it to be godlike, obviously, but people just want it to happen. Eventually, it's going to have to happen.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. It's one of those things where, like, if it didn't happen, if they came out and said straight up it was canceled, somebody's going to find an alpha version.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, and this is something that drives me up the wall. I get it. But there's a concept I call in my head the idealized perfect version of something,
mm-hmm.
which is to imagine that, like, if Duke Nukem Forever never came out, people would envision this game that was the perfect continuation of Duke Nukem. It had amazing control, fantastic graphics,
mm-hmm.
and that would have been the version they kept on thinking of in their heads. And it was good that this came out because people had to shut up about it. And it's the same thing that happens when, you know, like, you hear about, like, Next Level Games working on a Metroid game.
Yep.
And everybody's like, oh my gosh, this was going to be the greatest thing ever. I can't believe Nintendo canceled it. You know nothing about the game other than it doesn't exist, so you want it now.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing that happened with Duke Nukem Forever. And to circle back to what I was saying before, I think that's going to happen this year, Shenmue 3.
Maybe.
During the time of our preparation for this, Kickstarter has come and gone. They've successfully funded it, but they funded it, I think somebody says, like, 1/9 of the budget of the original game,
mm-hmm.
on technology that's 15 years more advanced than that. And I just don't know if it has I assume it's going to do, I'm not going to say it's going to do well. It's going to sell to people who want it. And I don't think many more than that. And I think it's going to be one of those games where people come out and realize, like, it was okay, but we've had games like this, and we've had games that evolved beyond what this offered us on the Dreamcast.
Yeah. It's kind of like, going back slightly to Mega Man and Mighty No. 9, people will like it, but I'm sure people will say, maybe not about Mega Man, but there will be people who will say about Shenmue, at least, there's a reason why, you know, it stopped after 2, basically.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we should accept that there are things that I absolutely love, and I realize in my heart and my head, I don't need anymore. Like, one of the examples, and I know people are going to hate me for saying this, I like Pacific Rim. Really do. I think it all you needed one movie.
Yeah. Well, I think it goes back slightly to what I was saying about Jurassic World and what you were saying as well, as they're going to make another one. But that's not based on an integrity standpoint. That's based on a business standpoint. Shenmue 2 only happened up to 2 because, from an integrity standpoint, maybe not. From a business standpoint, it only got up to 2.
Yeah.
That's actually a lot of the cases with these situations. Like, Fallout happened because, from a business standpoint, the company that made it didn't do well and sold it to Bethesda. Most of these mm-hmm. situations, at least in games, are because of just business, not full integrity.
Yeah, and I would say that for most industries. I think that, I mean, there are some people who make passion projects, but I feel like video games haven't gotten to the point where they allow that yet. I mean, you can say, there are some regards. Like, Pikmin 3 always sounds like it was Miyamoto's passion project. Mm-hmm. Like, it was something he wanted to do. But he's also worked 30 years at Nintendo to build up that type of clout. Because he still has to do stuff like Nintendo and Wii Music. Which are passion projects for a different reason for him, I guess. But yeah, it's not like, you know, like, Kojima has always talked about doing another Zone of the Enders, and that's never happened. And with the kerfuffle with him and Konami, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon until he does a Kickstarter of Ender Zone. So yeah, I mean, a lot of these things are driven by business, and what you'll see, and we'll talk about this one day, especially is that it's also just having an IP that people are familiar with instead of trying to come up with something new. We'll throw what we know onto a brand new thing,
yeah,
and we'll sell it to people. I mean, and I'm kind of enjoying this show, but it got Scream on MTV. I mean, that has so little to do with the actual movie.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Or Teen Wolf, which has nothing to do with the original movie. Like, it's a teenager, I guess, but it's not. He doesn't play basketball and other stuff. But so yeah, it's like we have this popular brand. Let's bring it back, and we'll see if it has an audience still. Like NBC bringing back Coach, because God knows, I don't know many people asking for a Coach revival. I don't know many people remember Coach in my generation.
I don't even know who you're talking about. And I laugh.
Coach, yeah, Coach was this old, Craig T. Nelson, which at this point I assume more people probably know as Mr. Incredible.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. I just know him for Craig T. Nelson just as an entity.
Yeah, but yeah, it was like his starring vehicle in the early 90s?
Hmm.
Yeah, something like that. This is going to be a little weird. I think I'm going to stop right now. We have a few more to talk about, so I think we're going to stop for this week.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. Then you two hold on for a second. So, yes, this was, I didn't realize there was so many to talk about with just this year in video games. But yeah, that was the first half of our, I don't want to call them revivals because it's just dormant sequels. It's long dormant sequels that have kind of come out, wiped off the cobwebs, and gone on to bigger and brighter things.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll be back soon with part two. I want to thank Dan and Scott.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. It's been fun for my first episode.
Okay. We'll see you folks later.